I'd like to start with a quote attributed to Will Rogers. If you find yourself in a hole, stop digging. The U.S. economy recovered much more rapidly than was predicted in the spring of 2020, and fiscal policies adopted early in the pandemic played a role. But expansionary fiscal policy was pursued too much and for too long. In particular, the American Rescue Plan Act, enacted in March 2021, when the employment rate had already fallen to 6% and real GDP had already recovered beyond its pre-pandemic peak, provided $1.9 trillion in additional funding and tax reductions, including large direct payments to households and substantial aid to state and local governments. Why did we do this? I think there are three potential and not mutually inconsistent explanations. First, we were still uncertain about the direction of the pandemic. And just as we underpredicted the strength and speed of the recovery at the beginning, we were also pretty uncertain, even in the spring of 2021, whether we'd have a relapse. Second, some of our leaders were plagued by recriminations about not having done enough in 2009. And third, a purely political explanation, they were in control of both houses of Congress and the presidency for the first time in a decade, and they felt that this was the time to stuff as much as they could before they lost the opportunity to do so. Whatever the reason, that's where we are. What path should we pursue now for fiscal policy? Well, first, do no harm. That is, stop digging. The debt-to-GDP ratio has risen from 80% of GDP before the pandemic began to 100% now. In the short term, we should try to reduce deficits through judicious spending reductions and tax increases. And the key here is to target demand and not supply. That is, seek policies that soften demand to help fight inflation, but not restrict supply. This would also be a good time to address the long-term problems that have debt on an unsustainable trajectory. Entitlements, Medicare, Medicaid, and Social Security already account for more than half of the non-interest spending of the federal government. Do I think that this will happen in election year? Of course not. But the problem needs to be addressed at some point, and the sooner the better. And we don't have a recession to blame for not taking action right now. Fiscal policy bears some of the responsibility for the inflation that we are currently experiencing, and a good fiscal policy can contribute to its reversal. Thank you.
As you were a student in 1985, you taught us macroeconomics from a neo-Keynesian perspective. To minimize volatility, governments would implement countercyclical fiscal policies, more spending during recessions and less during growth periods. In retrospect, countercyclical policies seem politically impossible. In your opening remarks, you try to explain why the Democrats increased government spending by $1.9 trillion, even when it was likely that we were already on a growth path. Do you think that countercyclical fiscal policy is impossible to implement in the current political environment?
When we're in a recession, they can increase spending and cut taxes. Governments don't have trouble doing that. It's much harder to have tax increases and spending cuts to relieve the inflationary pressure on the economy. It was true during the Johnson administration when the economy was running red hot because of the Vietnam War and he really didn't want to do it. It's been true in many administrations since then, and it's clearly gotten worse because I think the parties now are both seeking political advantage by giving things to their constituents. And that doesn't leave a lot of room for responsible behavior. It means that we're relying a lot more heavily on the Federal Reserve to do all the work. And as we've experienced over the last year, the Federal Reserve is not perfect either. To give them the benefit of the doubt, I think it was a little hard to tell at least a year ago how much of it was due to supply shocks and temporary factors and how much of it was due to a permanent underlying strength in the economy. It would be better to have fiscal policy playing a role as well, but I think unless it's automatic stabilizers, tax increases that happen because profits and incomes are higher, or unemployment benefits going down because fewer people are unemployed, those things continue to function perfectly well as countercyclical policies, but they're not active policies, they're automatic. Discretionary fiscal policy, when tightening is needed, is not really alive.
Well-anchored inflationary expectations is a valuable public good, and that now seems to be at risk. Have inflationary expectations already become unanchored?
We had very good monetary policy for a long time in terms of keeping inflation expectations well anchored. Everybody's talking about losing that anchoring of expectations. If you look at the implied break-even forward inflation rate in the TIPS market at 5 and 10 years, it's actually gone down in the last several weeks, and it never got that high. It's about 2.5%. 5 years out, about 2.3%, 10 years out. That's higher than it was. It was about 1.5% before the pandemic, but it's not like we're back in 1979 and 1980. I think if we didn't do anything about it and adopted unhelpful policies like wage and price controls and things like that, I think we could get ourselves back into that dark period. But I think we've got a while to go before we get there. 5 and 10 year implied inflation expectations have gone down in the recent weeks, precisely because the Fed not only took substantial action at its last meeting, but it implied very strongly that it was going to continue doing that.
The labor market is incredibly strong. There are 11 million unfilled job openings. How will higher interest rates impact the job market? And does the strong labor market make the Fed's job harder to slow down aggregate demand?
I find the current labor market numbers puzzling. In trying to think about how much the labor market tightness is feeding into inflation, you need to have a good measure of where we are relative to a normal non-accelerating rate of unemployment or the NIRU or what we used to call the level of full employment. And by some measures, we're there, 3.6% unemployment rate. That's pretty much where we were just before the pandemic when the economy was humming along. By other measures, the labor force participation rate is still a bit low, although it's recovered a lot. But on the other hand, you look at job vacancies, and it's absolutely crazy. And by that measure, you're way beyond any conceivable level of full employment. Perhaps that's the most informative in terms of what in the labor market is driving inflation.
The Fed wants to reduce inflation, and they've been increasing short-term interest rates. The Eurodollar market sees the Fed raising interest rates to 3.5% by next June, and then the Fed's expected to cut rates back down. Do you expect a recession?
The Fed is hopeful not. Other people think it's pretty unlikely we'll avoid recession if we want to bring the inflation rate down that much. The housing market is traditionally where you'd expect to see the action first. There's unbelievable housing demand, which has driven prices up during the pandemic. I won't be at all surprised if the interest rate increases go beyond 3.5%. We would have to be very lucky to be able to stop there.
You mentioned in your opening remarks that you wanted to increase aggregate supply. What policies can the Biden administration adopt that would increase supply?
To the extent that we have tax increases, we stay away from discouraging economic activity. I, for example, am not a big fan of increases in business taxes right now. If there is going to be any legislation this year, which now looks pretty unlikely, that's where the tax increases would likely be, and I think that's unfortunate, given that there are already built-in tax increases coming in this year and in the years to come from the Jobs Act, which had all these temporary provisions, and 2022 was a key year in terms of reducing incentives for investment, requiring amortization of R&D, and tightening interest deductibility and so forth. I certainly wouldn't go beyond those measures and add additional business taxes. That's what I'm thinking about when I'm saying try not to restrict supply. I'll mention a carbon tax just because as an economist, in order to maintain good standing in the profession, I have to do so. It's something that is obvious to economists as the way we should be doing environmental policy, and it would give us some revenue at the same time.
President Biden has proposed the opposite of your suggestion, a pro-carbon tax policy. He recently mentioned that he wants to reduce the federal tax on gasoline.
I could live with phasing the carbon tax increase in rather than doing it immediately. A temporary reduction in the gasoline tax. The last time I remember that being proposed was during the summer of the 2008 campaign when Hillary Clinton and John McCain both proposed doing it, and Barack Obama rose in my estimation by refusing to go along. Gasoline prices are temporarily high because of the Ukraine war. Introducing a carbon tax, even at a very small rate, just as a signal that we're going to be moving in that direction, I think would be a very beneficial thing to do. Monetary policy is going to be by far the most important thing we can do, and labor market measures to encourage people to work.
Alan, can you believe there are 11 million job vacancies?
I don't know what to think about it. The pandemic has made economists humble in many ways. Different indicators of the labor market don't mesh the way we usually see. As the economy softens, we're going to go through a period where the labor market begins to look not weak, but normal. My guess is the unemployment rate's not going to rise that much. Demand for workers is going to soften somewhat, so those huge number of vacancies is going to go down, and we'll see something closer to balance in the labor market. It would take a really big drop in demand and interest rate increases more than 3.5% for us to go to a situation where firms start shedding a lot of workers.
The current political forecast is that Congress will be majority Republican after the midterms. Do you believe there could be a political compromise that would reduce government deficits?
If I were to put my optimistic hat on, Biden has the ability to talk to Republicans. He's shown that. The parties have painted themselves into corners, and it will be hard to come out and meet. Republicans say no tax increases. Democrats say no spending cuts, and it's pretty hard to have a policy that softens demand if you take those two things as given. You know, a really terrible recession or runaway inflation, but short of that, it's hard to see much happening.
In your academic research, you focus on entitlement reform. Do you think we have any chance of changes to Medicare or Social Security to get these programs on a sustainable path?
If you think about what a good entitlement reform measure would look like, it would have a lot of advance notice. The way the 1983 Social Security changes had, those had increases in the retirement age. We could be doing that now.
I've always thought that we would pay the entitlement programs if society could afford it, and we would not if we couldn't. Why not change entitlements to be linked to nominal GDP instead of CPI so that we were honest about whether people get paid?
Who should be bearing the risk, the demographic risk of these programs? What the productivity growth rate is going to be, what the mortality rate is going to be. And so there's certainly argument for sharing that risk. That is, not all of it should be borne by the retiring generation. Some of it should be borne by younger generations. One of the arguments for putting some of that risk on younger generations is that they have more years to make it up. You don't go to an 80-year-old and say, oh, bad year, you know, too bad for you. There's a benefit to not to waiting because people don't save enough for retirement. But we certainly want to give them every encouragement to do so. And if their benefits are going to be lower, we want to give them every opportunity to stay in the labor force longer if they're able. I was on a National Academies panel some years ago. We issued a report 6 years ago that considered having an increase in normal retirement age. One of the disturbing things that's happened in recent decades is the life expectancies have diverged. Life expectancy depends a lot on income distribution. It was always related, that is, more affluent people always live longer, but it's become much more significant than it was. Telling a person who's going to die in his early 70s that the retirement age just went up from 66 or 67 to 69, you're cutting out a lot of his benefits, and others not so much. And one of the policy ideas we talked about was having an income-linked retirement age. If I were working in manual labor, I'd probably have a lower life expectancy too. One modification of our formulas could be to have a reduction in benefits that would be bigger for people who are living longer.
Alan, what are you optimistic about?
I have some hope that the economy is going to come out of the current situation without a serious recession. I'm somewhat hopeful that we have mixed government starting in 2023, that the two sides see their way forward to making compromises to actually give us some legislation in the fiscal area as well as other areas.